Well, to get a sense of what it might have been like in an era before anyone listening was born, before their grandparents were born, is a fish called the saber-toothed salmon, which you talk about in the book. And now extinct, but can you give us a picture of that?
They were huge. They're huge. If I'm remembering it right, they got up to 6, 8, 10 feet long, weighed a few hundred pounds, had big pointy teeth. But they went extinct before our species evolved. So we can't blame the saber-toothed salmon's demise on people.
Talk about scaring the dogs.
Yeah.
That'd scare the dogs.
And the swimmers.
And probably, I don't think there would be too many swimmers if they knew about that.
Maybe Hollywood will get a hold of this. But they were huge, and they didn't survive the transition into the Ice Age world. They died out in a climate change, apparently, before we evolved.
And when we look at the species of salmon, Atlantic salmon, distinct, different from Pacific salmon.
Yeah, if you trace them far enough back, their family tree converges about 20 million years ago. But one of the things I was fascinated about, again, as a geologist looking at fish, was why is there one species of Atlantic salmon and five or six species of Pacific salmon, depending if you're going to look across in Asia at the Asian salmon as well. And the story really seems to be one of changing landscapes. Again, as much as the demise or the decline of the salmon reflects changes people have rendered on the landscape, the evolution of the Pacific salmon into all the different species that we know, that sort of king salmon, coho salmon, drum salmon, pink salmon, and sockeye salmon, that also reflects a changing landscape in the sense that in the period in which those species separated from each other, diversified or radiated in evolutionary speak, that's the same timing that the mountain ranges around the Pacific coast evolved, that they basically rose from low gradient coastal plains into the high peaks we know as the Cascades and the coastal ranges. And the idea is that the salmon co-evolved right along with the topography, that as the rivers changed and new niches opened up, there were very few species in the rivers. Those species were, one of them was the ancestral salmon, and they took advantage of all these new worlds that were opening up as the streams themselves diversified. In the East Coast and in Europe, the topography has been pretty dead for a long time. I mean, the Eastern U.S. hasn't had much physiographic change in about 100 million years, and that's well before the salmon evolved. So there's been no sort of topographic impetus, if you will, for the diversification of the Atlantic salmon. And so the story of the differences between the Atlantic and Pacific salmon is really a geological story, as odd as that may sound.
Topographic impetus. What a great phrase. Yeah, that's great. Well, you talk in the book about how private interests began to curtail the salmon decimation in Scotland.
Yeah, there's some of the few examples I can find in the historical record where people have been very successful at restoring salmon runs that had been decimated are some of the Scottish fisheries, and where one of the unique things about Scottish fisheries are that they were privately owned. And so there were In some rivers, the fishing was curtailed for a few decades, a decade or two, to give the fish breathing room, and there was a very positive response. Some of the runs tripled in size once fishing pressure was let off. And so there are precedents for arguing that a little bit of restraint can go a long way in terms of salmon management.
And what's the situation like now in Scotland with wild salmon?
Well, the big concern with wild salmon in Scotland now is over the impacts of fish farms that have been located near the mouths of rivers. And the problem is one, not so much that the fish farmers themselves are doing anything to the wild salmon, but that the concentration of huge numbers of salmon, kind of like in a salmon feedlot, in the waters that the wild salmon have to swim past, introduces diseases to wild populations. It introduces pollutants. Introduces sea lice, sort of natural parasites to salmon that in normally dispersed wild populations, they don't get very large, but that when you get a lot of them together, it can really have huge impacts. Kind of like, and there's, I guess, human analogs for that. But the impact of hatcheries, of fish farms on wild runs there is a major source of concern now.
You talk about one disease called M74, which has wiped out wild salmon stocks in several countries.
Yeah, in the Baltic states, or in Scandinavia and the Baltic states. And I believe that was introduced from one area to other areas via hatchery transplantations. And so there's examples of efforts to sort of supplement runs in different areas by introducing hatchery fish that have kind of backfired because of the disease introduction problem. Yeah.
The notion that salmon return to the streams from which they respond is a relatively recent one. Indigenous people knew this, but scientists figured it out, a couple of hundred years ago, maybe less. How do salmon do that? This is just part of the amazing example of what kind of creatures they are.
It is. You know, there have been all kinds of ideas that have been proposed from that, ranging from there's tiny pieces of the mineral magnetite, a little magnet in their brains that allows them to navigate, that they read the stars like Polynesian navigators. But I think that the explanation that is probably borne out the best is that they smell their way home. That essentially each river, as much as, you know, as we're visually oriented, other animals may be much more olfactorily oriented. And apparently each river has its own bouquet that they can, once they get near the coast, they sort of zero in on the waters that they came from. And I really don't know what it is, but sort of subtle differences in the organic composition, whether the water presumably has run through the gravel or run straight off from the trees for the most part. But apparently they're following the smell of the river.
It smells like home.
Yep.
David Montgomery is a professor of geomorphology at the University of Washington. He is the author of King of Fish, The Thousand-Year Run of Salmon.